Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Susan Minot. She's the author, most recently, of Evening. Her other books are Monkeys, Lust and Other Stories, and Folly. And she has come to speak to me here at the Los Angeles Times Book Fair, where we're recording on site, so we're dealing with the circumambient sound, not of the studio and not of the purity we're used to on Bookworm. Susan, welcome. I wanted to begin by asking you the quality of chiaroscuro and memory waltz that goes throughout this novel, Evening, is rather remarkable, and stylistically it seems to have been, at least to my eye, immensely difficult to achieve. I wonder how it evolved, that style.
Well, the process of the book took about 5 years to write, though it was interrupted in the middle. I was doing some movie work. It started out, you know, every book has its own sort of evolution. It started out actually as a novella that was focusing on the relationship of the protagonist with her nurse as she's dying. And it was originally titled Report from Nurse Brown. What remains of that bit of the novella is about, I think, 3 pages.
In the final chapter,
of the whole,
essentially.
Yeah. Out of the whole book, because what happened is I started to become more interested in, I was interested in the relationship that went on between this woman as she's dying and maybe this last relationship she forms. Then I started to think, well, actually, what is really going on in her mind? It's usually not the report that you hear. You usually hear a report of the people surrounding the dying person. And so I wanted to get into her mind and imagine what it was like to die, or to know you're going to die, to be suffering from an illness. And with the combination of kind of drugs and being unable to look forward to a future, I thought she's necessarily going to be looking back. And it was a opportunity to explore memory, which isn't a linear process. She remembers bits and pieces of things, and it. When I was thinking of it, there is one kind of consecutive story that's told. It's she shoots back to 40 years before when she has this love affair. It's a weekend when she visits her wedding of a friend of hers. And that becomes, she ends up tracing that hour in, hour out, as one can in one's memory when you're going over some sort of voluptuous, intense time. But the other memories visit her, you know, 5 years in the life of a husband. It becomes a sort of series of impressions. So in order to convey this, the book had to go in and out of kind of sharper consciousness than vaguer consciousness. And I thought of it more as a kind of symphony. I mean, I don't know anything about music, really, except sort of, you know, what a symphony is. The different violins come in here. But I thought of it that way more than as a novel with a plot structure, because I wanted it to be like a sort of like a song.
Now, it seems to me to be dazzling and intricate, and to me to have a kind of tutelary prose god in Virginia Woolf, in a sense. Was she one of the presiding deities?
She definitely was one. You know, both To the Lighthouse and Mrs. Dalloway in their both concerns with time, with sort of a woman's consciousness, were very much very much a kind of guiding factor. There's also, of course, Proust and Faulkner.
Mm-hmm. But in particular, the structure of the sentences, that declarative nature, the way they're linked often by color or by a certain procession of an image repeated, I was particularly hearing the rhythms or derived rhythms of Virginia Woolf. And I wondered what it is about Woolf's style that is so appealing. She seems, in some sense, to have defined female consciousness in the novel for a certain period.
For me, she got me young, I think. You know, she was, and she did very much. She was very, kind of, not adamant, but particular in that she was writing about a woman's consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, she mm-hmm. reiterated that. And that was probably the first writer who was so sharp that way, that I came across, that was actually following consciousness that way. You know, I had been reading Joyce or Faulkner, and they did it, but not, she was the first one as a woman, I suppose, mm-hmm. to do it.
Well, in addition, what makes this more than a cerebral book or an impressive book is that quality of swoon, not just of fading consciousness, but the excitement of a person entering society, falling in love in public and hiding it, the rhythms of exposure and secrecy, which are, I had never thought of it before reading this book, the rhythms of disease as well. Someone does not want to expose her pain. Pain becomes like a secret lover. And so as she remembers this party and the rhythms of meeting a man she really shouldn't be interested in, he has a fiancé, it's counterpointed with the rhythms of the welling up of pain. And her hiding that pain from her children, much as she's hidden the relationship from her surround of friends and their family. That's not a question, but I wondered how.
I think also she, not even consciously, uses, because it's all she has to rely on at this point, is her memory in, as she says at the beginning of the book, the only thing for her to do is to get through this last thing, to get through this illness. When in fact, in the process of doing it, maybe trying to distract herself from pain, she finds that she goes back to this time that was full of pleasure for her. So in that same way, when, you know, you're having insomnia and you're trying to go to sleep and you'll just think back to, oh, that nice afternoon that you spent with someone. You'll go over it again and again, just as like a filling your mind with a lovely memory. She does that, but in the process actually does discover more about what that relationship meant to her and how it sort of maybe cast a sort of shadow over the rest of her life. Something she wasn't registering. I mean, unlike a, often people describe this book saying this woman was haunted by a love affair. She's not haunted. She remembers this, by the way, you know, it's almost, she actually in this Proustian way smells a pine cushion and it reminds her of this time. And then she suddenly, oh my God, I remember there was this man that I fell in love with. And which is, I think, is very much the way memory works. Mm-hmm. You do remember important things, but you also cannot.
I'm speaking to Susan Minot about her new novel, Evening, published by Knopf, and we're speaking at the thrumming and throbbing Los Angeles Times book fair, at which some 100,000 people are swarming. So I hope the background noise is not too distracting either for my guest or for the listener. Now, this is not the first time you've used an ensemble cast. In Monkees, essentially, there's a cast of siblings. But it is astonishing to me how dexterously you maneuver entire casts of characters through different time periods. Sometimes the children are acting as a Greek chorus, but that's the easiest. There's also an ongoing dialogue with the ghost of the missing lover, who is mostly asserting a different kind of permanence. If the permanence of memory is a sort of factual, visual permanence, this is an emotive permanence that, although she's had marriages without love since, the voice of a dialogue of seduction is going on also all the time. And then as well, the memory of three marriages and an initial wedding, and then several superimposed deaths that are sort of triggers for one another. They set each other off. Was the book a bitch to write?
It was a, I don't write in a linear way. I think of it more, it's like a mosaic. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, spread out. Basically, the writing becomes a way of establishing this world and what happened in the course of this woman's life. So once I sort of get a sense of that, then it becomes a matter of what to tell and what to weave in and out. So it was something that was very hard to keep in my head, you know, all at once. But, you have faith that while you're just concentrating on this part of her life, you just make sure it makes sense given, you know, another part. And you try to just keep track of where everyone is at what point in time.
In a way, it's all prefigured by your dedication, in which, in a rather spectacular series of comic phrases, you thank not people, but the spaces, the places they've provided in which you've written, whether they're cafes or patios, balconies, cabins, houses, in an array of countries across an array of times. And there is that feeling that a novel, like a life, is something stitched together from many places, which in turn provide angles that indicate something of the joining points that hold life together, that it's not cause and effect, that it's not the steady flow of time, but rather it's perspectival places from which to record and realign.
I remember when I first started reading books, you know, before you sort of accept that there's just this other world of words, I always questioned, just in comparing it with real life, I thought, God, this is so contained, this world. What, and they only, it's the same thing you see in movies, too. What, they only have one friend, and there's just this one thing that they do every day? And, and we accept it, because we, you know, the story is told, and all, it seems to make sense. But my experience in life is just that it's full of these, like you say, corners and different places and a lot of people and a mixture of different relationships. And there isn't just this one person and that one person fills that thing. It's all such a mixture and very varied.
I'm speaking to Susan Minot about her newest novel, Evening. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm, recording at the LA Times Book Festival. Now, it seemed to me, I guess one of the things I most enjoyed about the book was that we were hearing about a character sort of like the heroine of the Philadelphia story, Tracy Lord. But hearing,
not quite as jazzy, I'm afraid.
Yeah. but still, several men, a war over aspects of her character and what will prevail, What kind of life is she to lead? Will it be a life of survival or abandon? Will it be a life of love or material success? And yet, while that is a social comedy and you catch the ambience of an ongoing party and someone moving from, in a sense, suitor to suitor, it's all being done with such glinting suggestiveness that I found myself late in the novel still picking up clicks of character revelation and bits of experience that enlightened events that I'd read about 40 or 50 pages earlier. So it seemed to me that you had to be orchestrating the reader's perception as well in order to guide the reader through this maze, because the amazing thing is it isn't hard to follow. And it's very romantic. And I mean, I don't usually respond to books with, you know, comments, oh, it was so romantic. but it was in the best way. I wondered, how did you know what the reader would be able to pick up?
Well, it's like you, in characterizing our talk here, when you said to talk about books as if the listener knows what you're talking about. There's I think that's a nice way to treat the reader. You assume that they understand a certain kind of social fabric in order to comment on it. And more than, I've never been very comfortable with, and I'm sure it's why I'm a fiction writer, with generalizations about things. Some fiction writers can get away with it very well. They can say, you know, in this town, one behaves this way and that way. And, you know, they'll make these sort of lovely, sweeping statements that are very satisfying. But to me, it's not the way life seems. You know, you can only make kind of observations that indicate a kind of general behavior. And the world that Anne Grant, Katz, Stackpole, Lord, all her names, comes out of, it's a very particular one. And I think it's very particular to a generation. I think a woman who defines herself very much by her husband's, who is sort of relatively sophisticated, but hasn't really, you know, she's groomed herself to look after houses and considers herself sort of intelligent and with opportunity, but hasn't really found herself, what she can do. And this happens to be a talented woman who could have perhaps been a singer or something.
Mm-hmm.
But
in fact, what is the song she sings at the wedding?
Our Love Is Here to Stay.
That's right. Yeah. While reading it, as when reading a Jane Austen novel, I was convinced again of why a generation of novelists found marriage to be the central subject of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
One would hardly say this about the contemporary generation
right.
of novelists,
mm-hmm.
and yet somehow or other there is a convincing, what would you say, ethical texture about marriage, about joining, that recreates the solidity of the subject for the reader of Evening by my guest Susan Minot. And I wanted to ask you about that. Why a book now that takes marriage seriously in this way?
Well, it's like the book I wrote before this, Folly, which is set in the 20s and the 30s, I found not... It's one way of exploring present concerns by obviously looking back and seeing the attitudes towards, in this case, marriage, relations between men and women, you know, a woman's way of, you know, having a family, finding out who she is, and to look at the way a woman did it in another generation is a way of examining what is you know, constant in a woman's concern, which is something that I'm very, you know, perplexed by and curious about. So it's, you know, you to look at another time, I think, you know, I believe that people are not particularly evolving. I think the human heart and mind are as they were thousands of years ago. The world around changes, and it brings out, I think, different things in that heart and mind and makes people behave in a different way or not. But I am interested in what is constant there.
Now, by the end of the book, an odd thing had happened. In one of those Jane Austen novels, we'd be spending a lot of time trying to discover whether so-and-so were a cad.
Right.
By the end of...
People are very concerned about that in this book. Is he a cad? You know. And,
right.
and they are horrified that this could have been, you know, the love of her life. That he was a cad. They feel this is wrong somehow. When people ask me that, I look at them as if to say, where have you been?
Because by the end of the
book, what have you seen of life? You know?
I felt like it doesn't matter. You know,
it doesn't matter, in fact,
not only whether he was a cat or not, it doesn't matter what he was. What seems to have mattered was that he gave this woman a very intense physical experience, mm-hmm. that it was so different from the rest of her physical life that it's not until she is encountering a wasting disease that she encounters anything near as physically impressive. And that
physically overwhelming,
yes.
And thoroughly inhabiting, you know.
Sort of an astonishing thing. Now, do you think does that have a realistic as well as poetic truth?
I think so. I mean, I think that it says something about, you know, when, as Roland Barthes said, the statement, I love you, is a statement not about the object of one's love. It's a statement about oneself. And to be inspired to love someone or have someone move you in a way may not have a lot to do with that person's good or bad qualities. It's just whatever, how somehow it clicks in to the time, the place, where you are. And I think also it's not only inappropriate that a man, in this case, maybe not with her best interests at heart, maybe not the most noble character, would inspire that in her, but in fact likely that it could. There's a sort of willingness to abandon herself, in this case, regardless of the stature of the man, which is a very pure and romantic kind of, vision of love.
In turn, I sense that the men in the book represented a series of choices, both that life offers, but in particular also that literature offers. There's the kind of Henry James friendly man who always in James seems something on the verge of a cripple or an invalid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is the solid man. There is the cruel man, the Osmond man. And this man seems to be the purely enjoyable man.
Mm-hmm.
He saves one life, but he loses another. He dances well. He's brilliantly seductive. And it seems that he doesn't even have to speak. She is surprised when they agree about things. But he is not, one suspects, because agreement doesn't matter that much mm-hmm. to him as it does to her. So I wondered if you could describe the spectrum of man.
I think you've just described it pretty well. Yeah, well, you know, it has to do also with her character, the kind of man she responds to.
But he seems like the only man for her there.
Yeah. Well, he definitely has a, his concern for, like you say, his ability to feel pleasure and kind of give it it doesn't have a sort of calculated thing. It doesn't seem to really even have much of an ego. It's just this kind of life force. And I think as someone, because this girl's character has been quite, you know, she's got a mother who's sort of said, you know, don't show your emotions and it's best to keep under control. And she responds to that. She responds to this, he's a kind of more of an animal being, you know, with, you know, not unintelligent. And I think that's what really inspires her about him.
Now, in the way that one could see that folly would lead to evening in terms of a procession of decayed and attitude, does evening lead to what you're working on now? Is there a progression for you in writing?
I like to think of, I don't know if it's a progression so much as I definitely am aware of the last book and what I am sort of reacting to or not doing. For instance, after Monkeys, I wanted to do something very much not about family. And it was about sort of situations, practically nameless people in situations with each other. Evening, I think, went sort of deeper than I was able to with folly. I didn't feel maybe that it had gone exactly where I might have gone with it, or it started to get at something. The book that I'm sort of started to work on when I was working on evening is very, very different. So it's sort of, I would say, in reaction to it, it's going off, it's contemporary, it's mostly from a young man's point of view, actually.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for joining me. I've been speaking to Susan Minot, the author of Evening. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is J.C. Swadek. The development is by Beverly Walker, special production assistance by Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse mouth time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.